All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to ATAZ, your Talking Animals Speculative Fiction Book Club podcast by Clay Temple Media. I am Glenn McDorman. This episode, we are talking about The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, all seven volumes of them. And this is an episode that is part of our series on medievalism in speculative fiction. And so, of course, here I am joined by my regular co-host on this series, Jay Deal. Jay, welcome back to the show. I'm so happy to be doing this with you today.
Once a king or queen in Narnia, always a king or queen in Narnia. Happy to be back.
Yeah, that is how it feels here. I think listeners will probably be aware of this, but I will say it anyway, which is that this is the last installment in an entire series that we have done on Narnia across the network. Well, maybe across the network isn't quite right, but on multiple shows on the network. We had received a commission from one of our really awesome Patreon supporters to cover Neil Gaiman's Narnia fan fiction. That's a story called The Problem of Susan. So Brent and I have done that over on Hanging Out with the Dream King. But of course, for us to really talk about that story, it meant that Brent and I needed to read The Chronicles of Narnia again. I mean, it was just a requirement. And so, well, if we were going to read them again, then we should also do an episode on them. So that's the first episode. Brent and I did a rather big episode on Narnia. Then we did The Problem of Susan. Both of those episodes available on Hanging Out with the Dream King. But now, Jay and I are going to do an episode on The Chronicles of Narnia here on ATAZ. And we're going to talk about medievalism here, but before we do that, we really need to talk about, well, we need to talk about Narnia and us, Jay, right? We need to talk about our histories of Narnia. Why don't you take the lead on that? What's your history with Narnia, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, I have quite a lot of history with Narnia. Regular listeners will know that you and I grew up reading a lot of fantasy and sci-fi together. I was trying to think last night exactly when I first read them, and I honestly can't assign a date to it. It must have been around third or fourth grade, maybe a little earlier than that. At the time, of course, I was also a big churchgoer, and these were books that really resonated with me, were written in a kind of idiom that I could really understand. And, you know, the heavy allegories in them spoke to me as well at that point. I read The Chronicles of Narnia numerous times between, say, third grade and my senior year of high school, and really, really got into them. That they're possibly even more formative for my trajectory to becoming a medieval historian than Tolkien or any of these other works that we often talk about. Among other things, I wound up going to the local college in Illinois that had the C.S. Lewis Institute, the kind of archive and study center where I read some of his letters, actually in manuscript form. The original wardrobe is there. In junior year of high school, I wrote my first major, you know, long 25-30 page research paper on C.S. Lewis and kind of the role of Christianity within all of his works. By that point, I had read a lot of his other famous works, the Screwtape Letters, the Space Trilogy. So, yeah, I mean, although I kind of let C.S. Lewis go by the time I got to college and started studying medieval literature a little bit more properly, you know, between fourth grade and the end of high school, probably one of my most influential and most formative writers that I read numerous times over that stretch.
Definitely. And our story overlaps there. As you said, regular listeners know, we grew up together, but we were church friends, right? So your church experience is also my church experience there.
Yeah.
We were reading these at the same time, but we didn't discover them together. But it was the same year that we were reading them. And I don't remember which of us maybe was a little bit ahead of the other, but I do remember us, you know, having our regular post-church encounter at the, you know, I guess as grown-ups, we would, you know, adults, we would say, you know, it's the coffee and conversation, you know, part of church afterwards. I guess for us, it was the donuts and goofing off part of after church. You know, one of us brought this up and we realized we were both reading them. I had gotten, you know, this box set of mass market paperbacks from my aunt and, you know, was reading them at that point. And yeah, we talked about these rather incessantly, actually. And then we definitely read them again together at some point about a year later, maybe 2 years later. You know, it's a little bit fuzzy kind of remembering exactly which years these were, I guess. But yeah, this was a big part of our childhood, although you then did go back and read them much more frequently than I did. This is my first time reading them outside of grade school for me. Okay. And so that's been a lot of, which has been a lot of fun. Like, it was really interesting to read these again. For me, you know, Tolkien really was what was important for my trajectory in going into medieval history. And I think that will actually be informative, or rather that will inform our approach to talking about medievalism here, that I'm really excited about. But yeah, this was super important for our friendship, you know, when we were kids. It was important for us individually, but also important for our friendship. One thing I just want to say publicly here as well, although you know this already, Jay, but I will say it for our listeners, is that when we were kids, you had a poster of the really awesome map of Narnia. You had that hanging up in your bedroom. I was so envious of that. I wanted one of those as well. I don't think I ever actually asked my parents for one, but I just, you know, never got one. But then you got me a postcard version of that, became a cherished possession. It was framed, you know, a little 5x7 frame hung up in my bedroom, which then went to every apartment that I've ever lived in, well, in America anyway, I will say. It didn't travel overseas with me when I lived in Europe. But it is now hanging up in my son's room. It's hanging up in Finch's bedroom. Aww. You have seen it there. I made a point of showing that to you when you came to visit us. Because, you know, I said that this is my first time reading Narnia as adult. That's a little untrue, because 2 years ago, gosh, actually almost 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago at this point, I read the first two books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Prince Caspian, to Finch, you know, when he was a toddler, really, and would just, you know, at bedtime and nap time would lie in his bed, and I would read 5 minutes of just prose to him, something that didn't have pictures, so that he could hear the words and he would drift off to sleep. He aged out of, you know, that, out of, you know, wanting reading to be a passive activity like that. So we never made it any farther than that. But he knows, you know, Aslan. In fact, we were sledding this morning by a lion statue at our local elementary school. Their mascot is the lions, and we call that Aslan. I'm not sure he quite remembers why we call it Aslan, but he remembers that we call it Aslan. And so, you know, these are a feature for his life as well. And yeah, it was just important for me to say publicly that this postcard map, right, that was a treasured possession, might actually be the only real material object that survives from our childhood. That might not quite be true, but it's the only one I have in my possession, I guess. Yes, and so it matters to me to have given that to the next generation.
Yeah, that map, which I still own and which is safely tucked away in my closet here in New York, it's one of the few things that has made the journey from the Midwest to the East Coast with me and has stayed in my possession ever since. Truly is one of my prized possessions. There was a limited run of these made in their first printing, and I saw this map on the wall at the C.S. Lewis Library at Wheaton College, probably around sixth grade or so, and I really wanted a copy of it because it's a beautiful map. And the people told me there was basically no chance. They didn't have any for sale, and there were so few of them, I probably would never be able to get one. And somehow, what happened in some, you know, act of providence, my mom was shopping at some Christian bookstore in Wheaton near Christmas that year, and just was going through some posters in the back and found a copy of this map rolled away, hidden in some, you know, poster storage thing in the back of the bookstore with no price tag on it, no identifying information or anything like this, and snatched it up and bought it for me for Christmas that year. And yeah, has you know, if the children get their gifts from Aslan in the book, their swords and their horns and things like that, this is my gift from Aslan that I've kept in my possession to this day. And, you know, when I get transported into the future, I'll have to dig it out of some, you know, treasure room underground at some point. So,
right. Yeah. And it'll become the key to restoring the glory and moral virtue of your former kingdom.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. This is how I will bring back talking animals.
I didn't realize that was the provenance of this map. In fact, I hadn't realized it was so rare. So it is possible I did actually tell my parents that I wanted this, and they just said there's, you know, they might have even talked to your mom about it at church and discovered there was no way that this was happening. But I do remember, you know, it being a real longing that I had as a child.
Yeah. The only unfortunate thing about it is that, you know, in 1988 or something, if you wish to preserve something, what you did to it was laminate it. And I did indeed have this laminated, and it probably cannot ever be removed safely from that lamination. So I can't actually, I don't have the this quite same tactile experience of it at this point. I should have had it framed instead of laminated, but this is just what you did as a kid in those days.
Yeah. Well, when you ever get to a point where you want to hang it up again, I'm sure that some professional framing person can figure that out for me.
Yeah.
You know, that will be for our professional framing podcast, I guess, that we can start someday when we become professional framers. So yeah, let's move on to, you know, doing what we're here to do, I guess, right? Which is to talk about medievalism in this text. And I actually was surprised, perhaps you were not, Jay. In fact, maybe you just have a different idea about this than I did. But as I said, this was the first time that I had gone back to Narnia since being a kid. But it was not my first C.S. Lewis since being a kid. In fact, something that I did in undergrad and college, studying medieval history for the first time, was read C.S. Lewis's works on medieval literature, and yeah, really, really loved them, especially the Discarded Image. I thought is just an absolutely brilliant book.
It's a beautiful book.
But I was agreed. Then, yeah, absolutely beautiful, just and still so important. But I was surprised here then to read through Narnia and to just find a lot less of the type of medieval, well, medieval life, medieval history, medieval literature appearing in the text than I expected, right? The sorts
it's
of, true. I guess I was kind of expecting that there was going to be something akin to what we get in Tolkien, but there was just not, you know, there was strangely not that much of that sort of thing here, which isn't to say there's nothing, but that was something that surprised me.
I think it's good to remember that, you know, these kinds of stories, you know, C.S. Lewis thinks of them as kind of fairy tales. This is a recurrent term for them. And, you know, they have some kinship with medieval literature, I think. And certainly as I read through them idiomatically, one thing I didn't appreciate when I read these in like high school and grade school and can appreciate better now is that the language of them often evokes certain linguistic tropes of medieval romances, this kind of like, you know, one had never seen a better feast than this, or you know, phrases like that. But I think that their kinship is, you know, we're kind of like one level removed from medievalism here. I think that the kinship of these stories is more with early modern and 18th century writers who themselves owed a debt to medieval literature rather than having a direct debt to medieval literature. So, you know, things like Milton and people like Spencer, who themselves were kind of looking back to the medieval tradition. I think C.S. Lewis was looking to them in some ways. So you're right. The medievalism here is, while present, a bit more evanescent feeling, a bit more removed feeling than in something like Tolkien, which is much more overtly rooted directly in medieval source material.
This is exactly right. I think maybe one way to make this comparison is to say that Tolkien, well, maybe there's a few things to say here, but first thing I'll say is just that Tolkien writing The Lord of the Rings was doing that as an intellectual pursuit that was directly related to his own academic, his own scholarly interests. Yeah. Whereas that's not really quite what Lewis is doing here in writing Narnia. And of course, Tolkien and Lewis have very different jobs at Oxford, or at least they have very different careers at Oxford, perhaps we should say, that Lewis has become, certainly by the time he's writing Narnia, what we call a public intellectual. And so he's not at nearly as steeped in the research world to the extent that Tolkien is. And so they have different agendas here. But I think where we would find a lot more overlap, right, is that not to compare The Lord of the Rings to The Chronicles of Narnia, but to compare The Hobbit to The Chronicles yeah. of Narnia, right, where they are really engaging in what is more of the fairy tale tradition, or really more broadly, perhaps, the tradition of English literature of early modernity and the 19th century as well, where, you know, and that's really what they're doing, but getting a lot of medievalism mediated through that, as you said. And so for me, I guess what I'd like us to start with here, Jay, is, which was not what I expected that we would want to start with, or that would be the biggest place where there was medievalism. But in fact, the biggest chunk of medievalism here is actually Lewis's fantasy version of the Abbasid Caliphate of the 9th century that we get in a few books, but right, most specifically in The Horse and His Boy here, where we get this version of medieval Islamic civilization, a version of medieval Baghdad that's, I think, extraordinarily well drawn.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I mean, you're right. It's a surprising place to find the most overt medieval world building, you know, in the kind of classical high fantasy style is not in Narnia, but in its rival kingdom to the south, which is clearly based on the Abbasid Caliphate. And it is really quite well done. It has some of the orientalizing tendencies, especially when these characters show back up in the last battle, that you could find problematic in kind of modern works. But overall, we have here a caliph figure. We have here nice references to sort of the importance of the poetic tradition in medieval Islam, where figures in it are always citing sort of aphorisms from the poets. We don't learn that much about them or anything, but is nicely evoked. I think that, one of the funny things here is that in terms of a very literal evocation of a kind of medieval world. In Narnia, we get this kind of fantasy fairy tale world, and it's only in the antagonists to Narnia that we get this kind of very straightforward translation of something from our own world, from our own history, into this fantasy land, almost as if, Tolkien wants the heroes to be living in allegory, but he wants the antagonists to be living in this kind of more literal world in some ways.
It is a really fascinating juxtaposition. And of course, we certainly will talk about some of the medievalism things that we find in Narnia. But I want to talk about the literature here that we get in Caliban. You brought up these aphorisms. I actually want to read into the microphone here a passage from The Horse and His Boy. I don't actually have a good page number for you, Jay, following along. I will say for listeners that, I had gotten for you and me and for Brent all this really beautiful hardcover edition that we could have as a kind of memento of having done this series together. But it turns out that was really unwieldy to read. And so I went back to some paperback editions. I don't know if that's actually what you've got in front of you, but also especially unwieldy to hold up to the microphone. But this is in the chapter called In the House of the Tisrock. And in fact, this is a conversation that the Tisrock is happening with one of his servants here. And he's describing what Narnian literature is like versus Calormen literature, or Calormen, I guess we should say, literature here. And he says this: "The gods have withheld from the barbarians the light of discretion, as that their poetry is not, like ours, full of choice epithems and useful maxims, but is all of love and war. Therefore, nothing will appear to them more noble and admirable than such a mad enterprise as this." And this was something that jumped out to me. I mean, one, we should say that there's quite a bit in this book, as you said, about poetry and about literature, about storytelling that's really phenomenal. But this description of medieval Arabic poetry as just being these aphorisms and not being about love and so on struck me as a little bit strange, because, my sense of the tradition of or development of medieval Vulgate literature, I mean, French in particular, or really Occitan, I guess, in particular, right, is that our idea of love poetry that we have today really develops in the Middle Ages in southern France. It's this troubadour tradition, but that they were actually heavily influenced in their love poetry by medieval Arabic poetry. Now, it's coming from Spain. It's not coming from the Near East, right? But yeah, that's my sense of what medieval scholarship thinks now about the development of exactly this type of literature that's being invoked here, these love poems and so on. The idea of courtly love, that's so important in chivalric literature, et cetera, right? My understanding of that, you may know better than me, Jay. Of course, neither of us actually, we don't study literature, we're historians. But my sense of this is that the consensus view, right, is that that owes a debt to this civilization that Lewis is drawing on here, but is saying they don't have this sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Lewis was writing, in a more remote period of scholarship where perhaps some of these debts were not quite as well recognized at this point. But is drawing attention to, a real kind of ideological position that medieval Islam often took for itself, in relation to sort of the European barbarians, as they referred to them, the Franks and the other barbaric peoples of Northern Europe, which was that the barbarians for them were people of passion, whose emotions were dictating all of their activities. So hence, all their stories here in this passage are of love and of war, of scenarios in which you are sort of, your reason is overpowered and you succumb to your passions. Or as medieval Islam, you know, without downplaying the role of any of these ideas here, these terms that he's using here that, they are full of discretion, are working in a kind of more classical tradition, which still had importance in medieval Europe, whereby useful writing was about sort of how to reason your way through issues, how to keep your passions in control, that uses poetry as a way of kind of, controlling yourself, rather than giving into things. And Lewis's, I think, own tendencies in this are very clear. I think he thinks of the Chronicles of Narnia itself as a kind of poetic work, as a kind of spiritual poetic work. And I think very much is in sympathy with the kind of medieval romantic tradition, with its dedicated stories about love and the forceful powers it could play, about heroic feats of deeds that came from love and stuff like this. And is really steeped in this kind of poetic tradition that can be both secular in its stories of love and war, but also can be very Christian in its stories of spiritual progress and stuff. And is really trying here to create or to echo this, you know, now largely deconstructed binary between this kind of emotive medieval Western world and this kind of discreet medieval Islamic world.
Yeah, there's a real sense all through these books of, well, certainly that Narnia, right, is the central component of this world. In fact, we call the world Narnia, even though Narnia is just one element of it, right? And in fact, sometimes it can be confusing if we don't draw the distinction about what we mean here. And so, you know, that's the point of view is Narnia, which is a kind of fantastical version of a Western Europe that exists in early modern fairy tale literature, right?
Yeah.
But then gives us this perspective of a kind of wondrous and mysterious East, though also giving us this vision of an East that is tyrannical and full of slaves, you know, full of despotism and so on. We get, you know, both of these images here, but it's really the marvels of the East that I want us to talk about next. I think this is a really big feature of the expanded world outside of Cair Paravel and the lamppost and so on, that I think you wanted in particular to draw attention to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the most clear echoes of medievalism within these works. I mean, in this world, interestingly, the kind of Islamic world is not to the east, but to the south. If you look at maps, Kellerman is south of Narnia, across Arkan land. Whereas east, we just have some islands as we go into the oceans on the east, and then we have this unknown expanse. And the exploration of it is the focus of the book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, of course, which when I was growing up was the third book in the series and maybe is now the fifth. I'm not even sure. But here, Lewis is playing with a really clear medieval idea that is pre-medieval, the idea of the wonders of the East or the marvels of the East, which we can find in Roman geographical writing. But in the Middle Ages, we get a real clear textual fascination with kind of the ways in which the world gets increasingly strange and bizarre and wondrous the further east you go. And so, you know, there are many famous texts about this. In the Beowulf manuscript, there's the Wonders of the East, probably written from around the year 1000. More famously, the Travels of Sir John Mandeville in the 1350s is this kind of travelogue of a hypothetical figure going further and further to east and exploring all these wonders. Even on medieval maps, the Mappa Mundi, like the Hereford map, you can find visual depictions of the wonders of the East as you move further and further east. The stories of Alexander the Great's exploits that were told in the Middle Ages often emphasize this. And while there's really only one in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, only one direct analog of the medieval wonders of the East, and what the characters explore there, which is the race of the monopods on this island, these single-footed creatures, which appear on medieval maps and in medieval texts about the wonders of the East. The general idea that somehow the further you travel east, the more wondrous and the more bizarre, and the more you will encounter other races, sometimes called the monstrous races. This is a real play on medieval fascinations with the way the East becomes this land of inhuman marvels. And then it's, you know, here it's kind of crossed with the Odyssey or the Aeneid or something, this kind of shipborne voyage to the East. And so, you know, perhaps more than any of the other books, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader for me is a real homage to medieval ideas and medieval literary tropes playing on this idea of the wonders of the East in their journey out to Aslan's country in this book.
In these medieval travelogues, there's a real fascination with people who have a bizarre number of feet and also have their feet attached to their body in unusual locations, right?
Indeed.
And yeah, we get the monopods here in Narnia, but like there are some bizarre combinations here that we can find in these medieval and also ancient travel logs, these travel literature. And of course, we say travel logs, but right, we know that most of these are just totally made up. In fact, a debate that people, you know, scholars will often have about this or that text is, did this writer ever go anywhere?
And almost certainly the answer is no. Yeah. I mean, this writer went to the library and read, you know, the natural histories of Pliny the Elder and then, you know, cobbled together some stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they're great. They're so fun. I've used them in class. I know you've used them in class before as well. They've come up actually when Brandon and I have done episodes on Elder Sign, our weird fiction podcast, because they're extraordinarily influential in lots of ways. There's something else in Voyage of the Dawn Treader as well, where we get the, a kind of version of the medieval, although late antique in origin, but medieval legend of the Seven Sleepers as well.
Ah, yes, of course. Yeah. Although we only have three of them in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by the time we get to them. But yeah, absolutely. This would be another medieval analog to a medieval legendary concept that shows up, if I'm not mistaken, quite often in the romances of Alexander the Great. But I'm not as familiar with this as I should be, probably. You might be able to say more.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I tend to know about this more in its late antique context, actually, yeah. Where in fact, people, would be church writers writing church history, usually really just take this story as a given, right? That there are these seven sleepers in Antioch who will, you know, awake at some point. And this seems to be, well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but there's some scholarly discussion about the idea of the seven sleepers, the story of these seven pious, seven holy people who will, you know, are just in this kind of magical sleep, but who will awake again someday. That there's obviously a relationship between that idea and also the idea that King Arthur is going to reappear someday, or the idea that Frederick Barbarossa is going to reappear someday. There is something in medieval Christian culture that really likes this idea of there are these heroes who are sleeping and they're going to awake someday and set things aright again.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is echoed also in Susan Cooper's Dark is Rising the Dark is Rising series as well.
Yes, which I should say that was, you know, super important to our friendship as kids as well. You have brought that up as something we ought to cover here someday. You have been very gracious in allowing me to put that off until Finch and I can read them together because, when Finch was born and was in the NICU, I brought my childhood copy of The Dark is Rising down to the NICU from our room and read that to him when he was just a tiny, tiny little premature baby there. And so, yeah, when we can really read those again together, that's when you and I will eventually cover them. But I'm excited about that. Maybe we should also say, too, just for setting the stage for listeners about, I don't know, kind of the emotional meaning of talking about Narnia together is that we live in a part of the world that hasn't had winter in 2 years. But this week we have actual winter. We have snow. And of course, there's no way to have a magical wintry landscape without thinking about The Dark is Rising and also The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, right? And
absolutely.
Literally, I was a few minutes late to getting on the mic today because Finch and I were out sledding, which, you know, was our principal hobby, I think, when we were kids, as well. And so, yeah, just really a marvelous timing for us to be covering this episode. Well, another thing to think here, for me at least, about our childhood readings of these books, Jay, is that so far we've really been talking about The Horse and His Boy and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which were my two favorite books when we were kids. But were they yours? I don't remember which ones you loved the most when we were kids.
Yeah, so I did love Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Probably, for me, the kind of trilogy of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, and Dawn Treader were, at the time, my favorite books of the series. No longer true, I think, having just reread them on this most recent thing. I actually found The Voyage of the Dawn Treader less enjoyable than I did when I was growing up. But by contrast, I really enjoyed The Magician's Nephew on this read through in ways that I probably didn't enjoy quite as much when I was growing up. So there's been a slight reshuffling of things for me on the most, having gone back to them after so many years now.
Yeah, same here. And in fact, the conversations that I really remember you and I having about this series when we were kids are almost entirely about The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Like, I think that's right.
I knew the answer was that we loved that book collectively and talked about it rather incessantly. But yeah, I had the same experience here. I was less into that. I was also more into The Magician's Nephew this time around, especially the beginning of it, or maybe not the beginning, but when they're traveling, when they find Jadis in her world, I was like, this is amazing descriptive writing here. I really loved that. I was most surprised to discover that another book that I didn't like very much as a kid, which was The Silver Chair, was actually probably my favorite of them. That is not The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe on this read. I was quite surprised to discover that this time around.
Interesting. So I am totally with you in the early parts of The Magician's Nephew and the descriptions of Charn and the visiting of the dead world, which I barely even remembered existing when I sat down to read it, but here became... I thought some of the best writing in the entire series and some of the most evocative imagery throughout the entire time. I really enjoyed the entire book's juxtaposition between this dying world of Charn and the newly coming into existence world of Narnia. I thought it was really nice. And I did read it first, which I kind of told myself I wasn't going to. I was going to read them in their old published order, starting with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But I did wind up reading The Magician's Nephew first of the books, which might have had something to do with it, that putting them in chronological order. But I was really just struck throughout The Magician's Nephew, just as to how good the kind of evocation of kind of worlds in decay and worlds being born was. It's some of the most poetic writing throughout the entire series, I think. The Silver Chair, by contrast, interestingly, might be my least favorite book at this point. I kind of struggled to get through it in some ways. It didn't, for me, have the same pacing as the other ones. There's lots of clever stuff that I enjoyed, and I especially enjoyed the kind of shallow lands and the underworld and stuff like this. But for some reason, I found it a little bit more of a struggle to get through, especially the early sections. I liked the visit to Aslan's country at the very beginning, and I loved the being blown across the ocean in sections. But once it got into the quest, I found it kind of slow going for some reason.
Yeah, interesting, because that's the quest part was what I really loved the most, right? That this was some armchair backpacking for me, which I was surprised about, of course, because I love that stuff. And it felt like this was C.S. Lewis's version of Sam and Frodo in Mordor, right? That we've got these heroes on a quest in a kind of wasteland. I loved the descriptions of that. And, I think part of my love of that this time around is the fact that I haven't been camping in years because of the combination of the COVID pandemic and having a baby, right? And so I've been yearning for very much for that. That scratched an itch that, that hadn't been scratched for me in reality in a long time. But also something that I enjoyed about that that has to do with some medievalism is that where we get in Dawn Treader and The Horse and His Boy, this is where Lewis is, or these are the books in which Lewis is drawing on this, this Easternness, right? These marvels of the East. This is the Silver Chair was actually where we get the idea of Northernness, right? Where he's drawing on a lot of Nordic literature that I didn't know as a kid, but do now know as an adult, that really appeals to me, that I've gone backpacking in Norway, you know, since in between readings, and that really resonated with me. I think some of his descriptions here seemed right for that to me. But also, of course, I've been trained as a classicist, and, you know, in terms of the pre-modern literature that I really love, it really is Latin poetry. And so all of these dealings here in the underworld really felt like they were drawing on things from Ovid and, well, maybe especially from Virgil here, that I really appreciated in an intellectual way as well.
Yeah. So I think that you're absolutely, I mean, and it is a medieval quest story. I agree with that, right? You know, right up to the moment where we sort of encounter the itinerant knight and his lady on the road, which is a disguised knight on the road, which is a pretty standard trope of the medieval romance tradition, which really situates us in kind of Northern European literature and then eventually in Nordic literature. I will say that I love the idea of the visit to the underworld. And when I read it as a child, I had no idea that this was drawing on tropes from Virgil, from Ovid, and indeed from numerous other medieval literary sources, Irish tales about gates to the underworld and stuff like this. Even here, though, you know, I almost wish the story had doubled down a little bit more on the notion of visiting the underworld, that instead of it being populated by these gnomes and stuff like that, if this was really kind of, maybe without ever explicitly saying it, kind of the land of the dead or the land of shades or memories or something like that, where it really would have pushed the idea of this being the underworld in some ways. I think I might have enjoyed that. You know, for me, it was the imagery of the underworld here was really, really nice, but in some ways it didn't even feel otherworldly enough to me, because it was kind of populated with people, you know, that were flesh and blood, and, you know, had castles and everything. I could have done with some more otherworldliness, I suppose, in the underworld.
Yeah, it was a little more mirror universe, right? And yeah. It sounds to me like what you were looking for was a little more Dante. And I think that's a good segue into the next topic we've got in the outline here, which is to talk about Neoplatonism in these books, perhaps especially The Last Battle.
Yeah, I mean, that's where they really hammer it on its head, right up to Professor Diggory, you know, actually saying like, oh, everything here you need to know is in Plato. Why don't they teach Plato anymore in schools? But I think it does kind of, you know, suffuse a really large section of the Chronicles of Narnia, this kind of Christian Neoplatonism that probably in a lot of ways more late antique, your Plotinuses and your Augustines, than it is high medieval. Although you do have high medieval thinkers who are playing around with Christian Neoplatonism, but then becomes a big part of the literary tradition with figures like Dante, kind of exploring especially these parallels that are sometimes drawn between Plato's world of forms, this kind of intellectual world of forms where everything exists in its perfect forms, and Christian notions of the afterlife. And these are really clearly brought out in The Last Battle. I am reading, Glenn, from the nice, big, you know, beautiful version of the text here. And I think the most relevant passage and this version is on page 519, and I'm trying to get the book up here by my microphone and kind of...
Yeah, right. I've got it next to me as well, but you're going to be the one reading into the microphone, but I'll read along.
Yeah, but this is after they've gone into the what turns out to be the afterlife, although we don't know, but they've discovered that through the stable in The Last Battle is a new version of Narnia, a better version of Narnia after the old Narnia has passed away. And here, Lord Diggory speaking, when Aslan said that you could never go back to Narnia, he meant the Narnia that you were thinking of. But that was not the real Narnia. That had a beginning and an end. It was only a shadow or a copy of the real Narnia, which has always been here and always will be here. Just as our own world, England and all, is only a shadow or copy of something in Aslan's real world. You need not mourn over Narnia, Lucy. All the old Narnia that mattered, all the dear creatures have been drawn into the real Narnia through the door. And I won't read it, but on the next page, there's Lewis's attempt to evoke how the characters would have felt seeing the real Narnia for the first time, and suggests that looking at the real Narnia is like looking at the real thing, whereas looking at the old Narnia would have been like catching a glimpse of it in a mirror on the opposite side of a room. I think a clear hint of the idea of Plato's allegory of the cave, but is also a trope that is used in Tennyson's Lady of Shalott, where the Lady of Shalott can only see the world through a mirror in her room and is forbidden from looking upon the real world until she catches a glimpse of Sir Lancelot through the mirror and allows herself to look at the real world for the first time. These are all heavily Platonic ideas about a sort of real world of forms that exists above and outside this material world that we're trapped in, and becomes a pretty important component of Christian thought when thinking about sort of the distinction between the body and the soul, between spirit and matter and things. And, you know, although I think C.S. Lewis in Narnia has kind of played with the idea, you know, it's not a perfect one-to-one mapping of Plato's ideas or Neoplatonism. Like, the new Narnia still seems to be kind of material and perceived through the senses and things like that, whereas a strict reading of Christian Neoplatonism means everything would be perceived by the intellect, not by the senses anymore. But still, he's really drawing on this long strand of Christian Platonic thought that sees kind of the afterworld as the real form of everything that we have here on Earth, the perfected intellectual form of it all.
Right. And the idea that what we're living in here, you know, that we think of as the real world, is really just the shadowlands, right? This this pale image, right, of the real thing, this pale reflection, I guess, right, of the real thing. And yeah, I mean, there's some groundwork laid for that throughout the series, but it's not till we get to the last battle, I don't think, that we really see that in its kind of full splendor here, where, yeah, as you say, Lewis is really drawing on so much of these images, not just from actual antiquity and late antiquity, but throughout medieval literature. I had not thought about the Lady of Shalott there as well. But of course, as you mentioned, Lancelot, right? I mean, the Lady of Shalott is also this, you know, this modern interpretation or modern reception, right, of this medieval tradition.
Exactly.
Very much like the Chronicles of Narnia themselves are. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And this is something I really enjoy about these, right, is the way that Lewis is drawing on really the literary tradition of medieval literature, and really not just European medieval literature, right, but Mediterranean medieval literature and ancient literature as well, but then also, you know, this rich intellectual tradition, right? So we've got the stories on the one hand, and then we've got the intellectual history on the other. It is a very different type of pre-modern tradition than what Tolkien is drawing on. And I really appreciate that in ways as an adult that I just didn't as a child.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Lewis, far more than Tolkien, is really interested in medieval traditions of allegory, for instance, medieval traditions of poetry about spiritual progress, thinking about people like Boethius or figures like Alan of Lille, perhaps, who take theology, yes, real theological concepts about the Christian worldview, but instead of just writing kind of overt theology, write poetry about spiritual progress, about spiritual development. And of course, we know these kinds of ideas become really influential C.S. Lewis when you read through his actual overt Christian writings and his kind of meditative spiritual writings. You know, this is latent throughout the entire series, obviously, in the ways that Aslan is treated as an allegory, in which Narnia is kind of an allegory, but become most overt in the last battle, where it becomes clear that in some ways what the entire series is about is this kind of poetry about spiritual progress, about the improvement of morals, about the discovery of the truth of the universe, of the world, of the cosmos, and things like this, that it is a kind of pilgrim's progress like tale, in which kind of a medieval geopolitical world is suffused with a kind of medieval spiritual approach to poetry.
Yeah, thinking here again about this comparison between Tolkien and Lewis is that, you know, Lewis is writing this fantasy story in a fantasy world that's drawing on medieval, you know, medieval traditions, right? But really doing it in a kind of logos-centered way, whereas Tolkien, and I should say I am fresh off a reading of The Lord of the Rings, and that I was really struck on my most recent, I mean, literally days ago, reading of The Lord of the Rings, that Tolkien is drawing on a lot of the same things, doing something very similar, but doing it, you know, in terms of engagement with Christianity here, right? That where Lewis is doing this in this logos-centered way, by which I mean a kind of intellectual way, Tolkien is really very pathos-centered here, that there's this emotional-centered way, right? That one of the things that Tolkien is really drawing on in The Lord of the Rings are these images of Christ suffering, suffering for all of us that we get with, you know, Frodo's journey. But also there's a lot of that in Gandalf as well.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously we get that with Aslan and the Stone Table, in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, in a much more overt fashion, than Tolkien. And, you know, I think for me, again, you know, one overly convenient distinction that's used to talk about medieval literature sometimes is, the distinction between, say, allegory and metaphor. And I think Tolkien really leans into allegory a lot in this, that, you know, Aslan is pretty clearly a direct allegory for Christ. Peter, right, is pretty clearly an allegory for Peter-like figures throughout medieval history. and these comparisons are not subtle, and that's the point. In allegory, things are not subtle. Things are really quite overt. And I think Tolkien is leaning much more into the kind of medieval literature as metaphor, where things are evoked, are not kind of as reified, as clearly done and stuff like that. And you know, this way of thinking about, you know, so much, for instance, of the medieval Latin literary tradition that C.S. Lewis is drawing on is about allegory, like Alan of Lille's The Complaint of Nature, where, you know, nature is a character, is one of the voices in the literature. Whereas Tolkien is drawing much more on kind of vernacular traditions, I think, especially Norse traditions, much more like epic poetry, where there really aren't allegorical characters. You know, nature is not a character in them. There's no allegorical figures so much. And I think C.S. Lewis really wanted to experiment kind of with allegory as a literary form here, which, you know, finds its best expression often in Latin poetry. And you know, the parts of the book that I like, the series that I like the least, are occasionally when these allegories break down, you know, where Aslan says something like, oh, in your world, you must come to know me by a different name. You know, we could do without that. Like, if you're going to do the allegory, like, double down on it as allegory in some ways, because it is such an elegant way to tell the stories here, is through these kind of correspondences that are obvious but never get exactly spoken aloud.
Of course, Tolkien famously did not like allegory, although I think he overstated his own case there in disliking allegory, you know, because he's responding to people who felt like The Lord of the Rings was an allegory for the Second World War, which it, you know, definitely was not, just even in terms of the timeline and so on, right? And so responding to that, but, you know, perhaps a joke that we could make, right, is that in terms of medieval literary techniques that begin with AL that these writers enjoyed, Lewis loved allegory and Tolkien loved alliterative poetry, right?
Yeah, from
the
Anglo-Saxon
poetical tradition. And so, yeah, they just have these different interests. You know, even though they're doing something that's so similar, the comparisons, the contrasts are, I think, really rich in themselves. And just to keep thinking about that, I do want to go back to the business with Aslan and the, you know, his sacrifice on the stone table, which is certainly writing about the Christ experience in the way that I'm thinking about, well, Frodo and his journey as being like very much like Christ carrying his own cross. And then we have Gandalf, of course, who you know, dies and, you know, literally goes down to a kind of underworld and, you know, comes back because his work isn't done and so on, right? That there are Christ parallels, not direct allegories, but Christ parallels in both of those stories. That what I meant when I was, what I meant by saying that Tolkien is writing about this in a really pathos-centered way is that what he's writing about there is really a focus on, and this is maybe more true of the Frodo narrative, about what it is like to actually experience those events directly. Whereas Lewis, when he writes about Aslan's sacrifice, we get a description of Aslan being, shamed, being violated, being subjected to violence, right?
Yeah, humiliated.
Humiliated. Yes, right. That's exactly the right word there. We get that, but we actually don't experience it from Aslan's perspective, right? We get that from really Lucy and Susan, and it's their emotions that we're focused on there. And that in terms of what the sacrifice is, what Lewis is interested in is how that affects us. And then also how it works, like mechanically, with the rules of the world, right? Which is different from what Tolkien is doing, where the emphasis is on what was it actually like to be Christ in this way. And this is something that happens in medieval literature as well, right? That there are these two different ways of thinking about what Christ is and what Christ is for. And one of them is actually this Platonic, Neoplatonic way, where it's about how does the universe function and what are the rules and what does this do? That is this really late antique way of doing things. Whereas we get actually a really important shift in thinking about Christ that happens in the high Middle Ages, but maybe we see even more in the late Middle Ages, of thinking about Christ not in this kind of divine way, but as a human. What's the human story of Christ? And one of the ways that it really struck me on my reading that we actually see that distinction here is that the allegory for Christ in the story, right, Aslan, is Christ as, really in his late antique and early medieval form, it's Christ as a ruler, Christ as a king here. So very different medieval images of Christ that the two writers are drawing on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think thinking about pathos and logos is a really useful way to think about the distinction. And it's true that, we have this late medieval tradition of people really trying to empathize and imitate the suffering Christ, that the way to show devotion to Christ is to kind of try to relive the passion from Christ's position, to try to sort of inhabit Christ's humanity and think about him as a suffering human and stuff like that. That's very much not what we get with C.S. Lewis, where the emphasis throughout is on Aslan being inscrutable, almost incomprehensible. You know, this recurrent phrase, he's not a tame lion after all, makes us realize that he's not like us at all. He is a figure above and outside of our experience, to be seen, to be sought after, but not to be ever fully understood, and certainly not to be imitated in any way, right? He is inimitable in this world. Very much the kind of late antique, early medieval view of Christ in judgment, Christ as judge, Christ as conqueror, right? We have the famous early medieval poem, The Heliand, this kind of Anglo-Saxon poem about Christ almost as like a warrior figure, which is much closer to what we're finding in Lewis's tradition here, right? It's no accident that his Christ figure is not a human allegory. It is a lion, a beast, who comes and goes as he pleases, completely outside the domain of human experience. Whereas you're right, Tolkien was much more interested in kind of how do we relive ourselves this experience of suffering, of taking the weight of everyone, the weight of the world upon our shoulders, much more in keeping with a later medieval devotional tradition than the kind of early medieval stuff we see with C.S. Lewis.
And of course, this is something that scholars have done a lot of work on, in this transformation of these images of Christ in medieval literature, medieval art. And something else, of course, that we could talk about, though we won't because we need to start wrapping up for time here, right? But our ideas of war and violence and what the relationship with Christianity is like. I think there are some distinctions there in Lewis and Tolkien. And even if we aren't comparing Lewis to Tolkien there, there's still a lot that would be, I think, extraordinarily fascinating to focus on here in terms of medieval discussions about Christianity's Christian justifications of war, the role of war and violence in its relationship with Christianity, things that I have worked on as a military historian, getting ready this semester actually to teach a course that will do some of that. There's quite a bit of work to do there as well that would be fun. Perhaps we'll come and do a sequel where we can get into that a little bit more.
It's so funny. It's just a quick side note. For the life of me, if you had asked me to name how many battle scenes there were in the Chronicles of Narnia before I'd reread them, I would have told you oh yeah, there's that one big battle in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And that's all I would have remembered. But it turns out that actually battle happens kind of a lot, not always exactly on screen or on the page, but there's more of them than you think. There's one in the last battle. There's a big one in The Horse and His Boy. There's a lot of invading and battling and armies in the Chronicles of Narnia. I would have never remembered this fact at all. It is a topic worth exploring more. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, I think if we were going to do that exploration, which I said, we're just out of time to do here today, we would also want to think about the violence of returning to the school, right? And revisiting some violence on your own tormentors, on bullies and so on. But yeah, there's a lot of work to be done here. Presumably scholars have done this that we just haven't had access to for our preparation for this episode. But I think we'll bring this to a close here. This is the part of the episode, Jay, where we usually talk about what's next. And in the past, I've made a little bit of a game of this, but what I want to suggest that we do here, of course, you have full veto power of this, but I just want to suggest that we return to our roots here and get back to Asimov. We could do the next book, which is Foundation and Empire. It's two parts. So we could, do one episode on part one, the general, then do another episode on part two, the mule. Would also give us a chance maybe to talk about, further seasons of the TV show, if that sounds good to you.
I love it. I really enjoy, spoiler alert, I really enjoyed season two of Foundation in its televised format, and it made me realize there is a lot in Foundation and Empire that I had just completely forgotten about, and I was meaning to go back and reread it anyway in the near future, having watched that, so let's absolutely do it.
Okay, perfect. That's awesome. And I did watch the first two episodes of that season and then just, got busy with something and so couldn't watch anymore. So maybe I will keep it that way. I think when we do that, you can be the person who has seen it and, more recently and is approaching the text from that perspective. I'll do the opposite and we'll see what what strange alchemy that that does for us here. So, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman. Jay, let me just say thank you again for coming back on the show. This was an absolute delight for me.
Always a pleasure, especially with Narnia.
Well, all right. Well, we will be back next time then, I guess, with the first part of Foundation and Empire. Very excited for that. But until then, I hope you'll remember that if more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world.